The only real question is, when do we reach that 1 million? This massive institutional adoption that's going to take place, we're really only at the beginning of it. Once we hit that 100,000, I think it's a very important psychological level. From there, we could easily see it doubling, tripling, quadrupling in value. Certainly in terms of money, there's a winner-takes-all scenario. When people realize that real estate is not the best store of value, but that Bitcoin is the best store of value and the hardest asset that will ever exist, the current financialization of real estate will end. Those trillions of dollars of wealth will flow into Bitcoin. Same thing with the stock market.
How do we get to this 1 million US dollar mark?
Yeah, so I think most people nowadays who actually know anything about Bitcoin are agreed that Bitcoin will eventually reach the $1 million target. I think, yeah, other than maybe the Peter Schiffs of this world and those types. So the only real question is, when do we reach that 1 million? I think the how, obviously, there is, you know, massive amounts of capital that need to flow into Bitcoin. And how fast we get there really depends on how that capital gets into Bitcoin. So the three main factors that I've sort of looked at are the halving, the ETFs and institutional adoption, and this sort of infinite feedback loop that's been mentioned by a few different thinkers, including Saifedean Ammous and the new sort of Plan G, Giovanni. So I think the first factor for me clearly is the halving, which there's been some controversy over recently as to whether it has any real effect on the price at all. Fred Krueger, notably on Twitter, was criticizing this. I think Giovanni Plan G, he was criticizing this as well. But for me, really, I see it as the sort of the starting point for each of these 4-year cycles that we've had so far. And that's to do really with a supply shock. So as we know, of course, every 4 years, there's a halving event where the new supply for the block reward is halved. And this really brings down the overall inflation rate of Bitcoin. This cycle, it'll, of course, go below the inflation rate of gold, which, as we know, for thousands of years has been this sort of the main hard money asset. And gold also has a very high stock to flow ratio, which is, I believe it's 70, which means it's like 70 years. It'll take 70 years to replace the current supply of gold. But one thing that's quite different about Bitcoin is that it doesn't, you know, gold's stock to flow ratio may be high, but it's also very stable because the new supply of gold is basically there's a steady flow and there's no sort of supply shocks that come along the way. Whereas with Bitcoin, every 4 years, there's a sudden supply shock that's caused by the halving event. So this means that Bitcoin's stock to flow ratio is not only just going up, but it's also going eventually to infinity, which is something that Saifedean points out in the Bitcoin standard. So this fact that Bitcoin's on this trajectory to infinite stock to flow means that it's also the scarcest asset that will ever exist and the hardest monetary asset that will ever exist. And these constant supply shocks with, at the same time, increased demand, because this is the other thing that maybe Plan B's model is being criticized for, is the fact that it doesn't take into account demand, or they say it doesn't take into account demand. But because Bitcoin is essentially a Veblen good, which is a good that the higher it goes in price, the more people want it, demand increases as the price goes up, and then we get these supply shocks along the way, which then further increase the demand. It's like a cycle, as we'll get into later. So that's the first main factor. The second factor, of course, is the institutional adoption, which is a new factor, something which we didn't have in, let's say, 2020, 2021. And that's due primarily to these US ETFs. As we know, a lot of the financial world is based in the US. A lot of the capital's in the US. These big institutions like Fidelity, BlackRock, and all these other ones, which have trillions and trillions of dollars in assets. I mean, BlackRock has over 9.1 trillion and Fidelity something like 7 trillion. So all of these, this massive amount of capital, which is invested into various funds, ETFs, stocks and shares, all that sort of stuff. And now, because we had the launch of these ETFs in January, now there's finally a pipeline or a method for these traditional financial institutions to get into Bitcoin. So that is really a trigger to what Michael Saylor calls the Bitcoin gold rush that will last 10 years, which I quoted in my article. This massive institutional adoption that's going to take place, we're really only at the beginning of it, but it will continue for many years to come. And a lot of that that capital is going to stay in Bitcoin. It's not just sort of coming in and out. This third factor, which I wanted to touch on, was the infinite feedback loop. And this sort of touches with, it ties in with the concept of the financial singularity. So this idea that Bitcoin is like a black hole. It's like a singularity that sucks in all the capital from various assets. Because most assets at the moment are basically trying to maintain value or increase value where possible against this rising tide of inflation. As currencies are being consistently debased, investors and individuals have to find a place to put their wealth. So many of them put it into the stock market, S&P 500. They put it into various index funds attached to that. Real estate, of course, is one of the biggest stores of value that people use now. Either investing in property or just in their own home. Some people, it's just their own house is their store of value, which they can sort of borrow against and et cetera. But a lot of that wealth inevitably, I think, will flow into Bitcoin, and the housing market, real estate will be, it'll lose its place as a store of value over time, and we'll eventually get the sort of more utility value of real estate. That's the sort of financial singularity. And this feedback loop, of course, as the Bitcoin network expands, more and more users are adopting Bitcoin. As the network expands, the price expands. As the price expands, more people get into it. And there's also an increase in security as more people are mining it, more companies are mining it, the hash rate goes up. So it becomes a securer network, a better network for storing value, a stronger monetary network and harder asset over time. So this is the sort of general pattern. These are sort of the general things that I see are leading us towards 1 million, and then it's just a question of how fast. And I think as if we continue to witness the current sort of inflow of capital, we could easily see a $1 million Bitcoin within possibly near the end of this cycle, maybe even 2027 or even earlier, if the amount of capital increases rapidly. Let's say they double inflows from the into the current ETFs, then we could see it even you know, in the next several years, you know, 2-3 years possibly. I'm not sort of guaranteeing any of that. This is, you know, it's sort of a wild prediction, but you know, it's just based on what I can see at the moment. Things can change, you know, as we can see even with geopolitical events. Things have changed since last week when we were trying to record this interview. So, you know, there's a lot of factors. You know, there was the COVID crash that nobody predicted, where Bitcoin went down to like 3,000 to 4,000, you know, in 2020. And now we've just had a crash due to geopolitical tensions. So there's a lot of stuff that you can't predict, and there's no guarantee that flows will continue at the current rates or will increase. But I don't see any reason why they shouldn't increase due to this positive feedback loop, due to this the fact that Bitcoin is a Veblen good. So yeah, we could get there faster than many people anticipate. And that could lead to potentially a super cycle, which people have been talking about for a number of years now. But we saw the same thing happen with the gold ETFs when they were launched in, I think it was around 2004. You know, once those ETFs were launched, gold sort of, you know, shot off on this roughly 8-year super cycle going up and up and up. And now gold is actually higher than it was even at the peak of that that super cycle. So, you know, we'll see what happens, but this is how I see it happening over the next, let's say, you know, 5 to 8 years.
Yeah, it's amazing, because I think we never have seen so much inflow of capital coming to Bitcoin. Let's just think what the last 4 years have been, what the last 4 years came to. In the last cycle, we got the publicly traded companies with Michael Saylor coming in. We did not have that before. We have countries now where the leader of the country is shitposting about Bitcoin and is buying Bitcoin on a seemingly daily basis and is building Bitcoin bonds and stuff like that. This will have some effects that, and because they are also really successful, and I think they will be even more successful in the long run, this will have followers, other countries that come into. Then the ETFs are coming in, as you said, and then we have even more stuff afterwards that probably we don't even know about. I think Peter Dunworth is talking about that structured products are coming in, bonds are coming in, products that we don't even have on the radar right now. And then there's all the pension funds that are unlocked with the ETFs. There's so much capital that is kind of waiting now to get into Bitcoin and is flowing into Bitcoin in the next like 3, 4, 5 and like even longer, like the next 10 years, but especially the next 2, 3, 4 years, I imagine like this capital inflow in Bitcoin just rising up so, so fast. And one aspect we did not cover from now is the mental milestones. How much does like 100K Bitcoin price, 500K Bitcoin price, 1 million Bitcoin price then also influence the whole game theory when every news, like, because people have this mindset, oh, it reached at 7K, like 2021. I think most people have this like in their mind. Most people also know, oh, it's not that far away that we hit the 10K when we actually see the mainstream. But I think a lot of capital will be unlocked and a lot of fear of missing out from the general population that are not in Bitcoin will be unlocked when once we hit this 100K weird target milestone. What do you think can be the significance of that 100K milestone?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of it is psychological. The markets are very psychological, you know, and there's fear of missing out. Everyone wants to pile in. And, you know, this does relate to what I was saying about the Veblen good concept, because there's that meme in Bitcoin where, you know, that there's two sort of cues to buy Bitcoin. You know, one is where Bitcoin is like $16,000 and the others where it's like $70,000. And there's like hardly anyone trying to buy Bitcoin at 16,000, but everybody, there's a massive long queue of people trying to buy Bitcoin at 70,000. You know, and the reason for that is because it is that psychological fear of missing out and seeing, you know, this is that amazing, you know, asset that's just going up. You know, we need to get a hold of this. It's now 70,000. So the same thing will happen, obviously, when Bitcoin is 100,000. You know, people are going to get crazy because they'll think, wow, I mean, you know, this thing was at the bottom of the last cycle, like, you know, 15,000-16,000. Now it's 100,000. Oh my God, if I don't get some of this, you know, what if it's going to 1 million? So there is that. I think that definitely affects the retail market, you know, the average sort of person. At the moment, I think a lot of retail isn't paying attention to Bitcoin, even when it was hitting a new all-time high of around 73,000 to 74,000. I don't think a lot of retail was paying attention. So yeah, we do have to hit some more sort of psychological milestones before people start paying attention, because just as like 10,000 was a major milestone back in, let's say, 2017, you know, and that sort of kicked things off and people were like, oh my God, Bitcoin is $10,000, I need to get some of this. And of course then it shot up to roughly 20,000 and then crashed. I mean, it was only at 20,000 for a very tiny, you know, brief speck of time, but that was sort of the hyperbolic blow off top. I think this last cycle, the 2020-2021 cycle, I think we didn't quite have as much of the FOMO as we had in 2017. You know, when you look at the charts, I think it was sort of a disappointing cycle in a way. It was very disappointing for me. I mean, not just for, you know, even those who are following sort of Plan B's predictions, you know, because he had two sets of predictions, one where it was going to hit an average of 50,000, his original, and then his second was that it would have an average of 100,000. And we sort of never reached the second version of his model. And a lot of people were anyway, even, you know, independent of his models, were hoping that we'd reach that next order of magnitude, because, you know, it seems that Bitcoin keeps going up an order of magnitude every cycle, from the 1,000 sort of limit and then the 10,000 limit. And then people assumed naturally we'd hit 100,000 in the previous cycle. So a lot of people were kind of disappointed. And there's probably a lot of reasons for that, you know, with the sort of China mining situation and the various FTX collapse and then BlockFi and all these other Celsius various collapses and things. So I think it was a very strange time as well with COVID. But I do suspect that this cycle will be quite different, especially with the financial institutions on board. And I think even the financial institutions themselves will get a bit of FOMO as the price goes up. So yeah, once we hit that 100,000, I think it's a very important psychological level. And from there, we could easily see it, you know, doubling, tripling, you know, quadrupling in value, potentially within this cycle. I mean, some people, you know, talk about 150,000. I think it's way too conservative for a top for this cycle. You know, 150,000, I think we're just getting started. You know, some people say 300,000 or 400,000. I think Plan B's is something in the 500,000s in his prediction. But I mean, anything within that range is possible. Certainly, you know, if we keep hitting 100,000 targets, each one of those will have a very, I think, important psychological effect. You know, if it went from 100,000 to 200,000, doubled, people would, you know, really FOMO in. Imagine it goes from 200,000 to 300,000 or 300,000 to 400,000. So, yeah, I think each one of those is going to be quite important on the path to 1 million. And who knows, you know, if we hit 1 million this cycle, that would be extraordinary. I mean, it's not guaranteed, but if we hit 1 million even the next cycle, you know, 2028, you know, that's quite possible as well, 2028, 2029. But yeah.
Amazing. It's so true. When you look back at the 2020 and 2021 cycle, we had so much drama. I mean, I heard a lot of people when I asked, like, how did you came in and stuff like that. I think a lot of people actually came in the 2020 area because not only because of the price, but also because they finally had time to read stuff. They finally had time at home and sitting and doing stuff. I heard that so many times in like even friend circles and online and in podcast interviews where they're like, this was this whole rat race of you're in your life and you do stuff. And then all of a sudden COVID hit and you were forced to sit at home, I think was bad, but it has also some good effects on society because people all of a sudden had time to pick up a book that they did not have before. They had time to research about stuff that they did not have before. So I think, I don't know if COVID was a good or bad for Bitcoin. In the end of the day, it does not matter in the long run, but I don't know if it was in the short run good or bad. Probably it was good because the US dollar was devalued at a rapid pace, way much faster than before, and people had time to think of that stuff, and that was actually a topic. And I think this inflation trigger, this is another aspect of the price running up that we did not cover till now. The US dollar, not only we have more capital inflows and more market that and purchasing power that Bitcoin covers, but also the unit that we are measuring in right now, the US dollar, is just devaluing at a rapid pace. How do you see inflation and this all playing into in the long run, like 5, 10, 15 years in the fiat currency? Because some people say, we can have hyperinflation in like 5 years. We can hit hyperinflation only in like 50 years. There are a lot of different aspects. I even had a guest on that said, we will hit hyperinflation in the US dollar in 3 years, which I find a little aggressive, but I will not rule it out because if you print a lot of money, a lot of things can happen. How do you see that aspect playing into price?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of covered this a bit more in some of my previous articles, like the case for the $10 million Bitcoin that I wrote I think it was 2021. I was sort of looking more at the factors that make Bitcoin important and where it will sort of go in the ultimate long-term trajectory. Because I think essentially, Bitcoin is on a path to hyper-Bitcoinization, and that will mean all currencies essentially trending to zero, unless, of course, they're backed by Bitcoin, which is a possibility. That would be sort of the only kind of escape valve for the US dollar, as if they say, let's put this on a Bitcoin standard. You know, $1 is, let's say one Satoshi or 10 Satoshis or something like that, and we just fix it at that price. Then, of course, the US dollar will stop inflating and we'll have a fixed supply. So that's a possibility. You could eventually have a strong, very strong dollar if it's backed by a hard asset. And I don't think that we're going to go back to gold. Gold has sort of failed as a backing for currency. I know they're trying to do it. I think it's in Zimbabwe now. They're trying to reset their currency again, this time somehow backing it with gold, but I saw they were backing with gold and other currencies or something like that, which obviously wouldn't help because other currencies are all pegged to the petrodollar and the petrodollar is inflating to infinity. So any attempt, this is the other thing I don't get about stable coins. I mean, there's no such thing as a stable coin because it's stable in comparison to what? You know, if the US dollar is inflating and stable coins are pegged to the US dollar, it's not exactly stable. It has the illusion of stability because people think $1 equals $1. But $1 is never $1 because it's, you know, the dollar has lost maybe 97% or 98% of its value since the beginning of the 20th century when it was on a gold standard, a hard gold standard. But it's been sort of debased and continually either re-pegged to a different amount of gold, as they were doing with the various world wars at the beginning of the 20th century, or completely taken off the gold standard by Nixon temporarily in 1971, which they've never reversed, even though it's supposed to be temporary. So, you know, the US dollar is ultimately on a destructive path, and it looks like the US is stable. It looks like the US will remain this superpower. You know, there's always been talk of China taking over and that sort of thing, and the Chinese currency. But in reality, every empire or every superpower is stable until it isn't. And we saw that with the Roman Empire, which seemed to be permanent and had a permanent currency and permanent control. But once they started messing with their currency, once they started debasing, removing the amount, well, gradually decreasing the amount of silver in the, I think it's the denarius, you know, gradually had less and less and less silver until it had almost no silver at all. And then they had to introduce price controls and force people to remain in the same job and to only charge certain amounts of money for certain products, and all these other economic controls that we see being implemented today by various governments. Eventually, Rome faced systemic collapse, and the barbarians took over, and all their systems went to nothing, and their currency went to nothing, and then other currencies, harder currencies, had to replace it later on. I think even with the US dollar, you know, we saw at the beginning of the US dollar, you know, they had the continental dollar during the American Revolution. And then that continental dollar was backed by nothing. So it went to almost nothing in value, such that they had the phrase, not worth a continental, which means not worth, you know, anything really. And then that was replaced by a bimetallic sort of gold silver standard. And then in the Civil War, you know, they had to spend huge amounts of money to, you know, fight the Confederacy. So they took the U.S. off the gold standard and printed greenbacks. Lincoln printed the greenbacks, which were massively inflated. And then after that, they had to go back to the bimetallic standard and eventually more of a gold standard. So every time you've had a fiat currency, pure fiat currency, eventually it has become so debased that you've had to go back to a hard money standard, except for the last, let's say, 40, 50 years of this current experiment with the petrodollar. But that will eventually come to an end, and it could even be a very sudden end. And of course, they'll try and prevent that through CBDC, central bank digital currencies. They'll create some sort of digital currency that they control and they can monitor and make sure that you know, you're actually spending it, maybe forcing you to spend it somehow, or it expires. You have maybe 1 year to spend it, or the currency disappears or something like that. They'll come up with ways around it. But that's similar to the various attempts I was mentioning about the Romans, how they tried to prop up their currency and, you know, prevent people from spending, you know, more than a certain amount. But all these kind of economic controls are ultimately unnatural, and they ultimately fail because the free market prevails in the end. So the US dollar, I think, is going to continue to rapidly lose value, especially with the incentives that currently exist to spend money on war, to buy armaments to send to Ukraine, you know, all these various big government projects, student loan forgiveness, massive budgets, even servicing the current debt. You know, the current debt in the US is getting unmanageable, where the, you know, I'm not following it entirely at the moment, but I think at some point the interest alone will be, you know, $1 trillion. So when that itself is a sort of feedback loop, but it's a negative feedback loop that's going to continue destroying the currency until it becomes so unsustainable. The debt becomes so unsustainable, the deficit, the interest on that becomes unsustainable. And they do have to have some kind of reset. But if you have a reset, you need to reset it with something hard, something that actually has value. And at the moment, the only real alternative to the dollar is Bitcoin.
I told you a lot about 21 Bitcoin, the best place for me to buy Bitcoin directly on a Bitcoin only exchange. But now let's talk about how to secure your Bitcoin. Once you got Bitcoin, you don't want to leave them on exchange. You want to take self-custody. You want to take responsibility of your own Bitcoin. That's why I recommend getting a BitBox. BitBox is an amazing wallet where you can not only keep your Bitcoin in a simple way very secure, you can even create a passphrase. With that passphrase, you can basically create a hidden wallet on the device itself. Make sure to buy your BitBox in the link down in the description, and with code Robin, you even get a 5% discount.
Absolute. That was an amazing rant. I loved it. there are so many great topics in there. There's like gold in there, which I think is great money till Bitcoin came along. Mm-hmm. Then we also have the topic of CBDCs, which I covered sometimes on the podcast. And I had quite different opinions on that, if it's accelerating or slowing down the Bitcoin adoption. I personally think it could actually be an acceleration for Bitcoin adoption, because the government is telling the general population that something digital has value, and it makes the fiat system just way worse, because there's more monitoring, more control, in the end, probably also more devaluation going on. How do you see CBDCs playing into the adoption of Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, well, at the moment, you know, CBDCs are sort of a known unknown, as they say, because it's very difficult to say what they will look like, what they will be like. We've had sort of indications from, I think, the EU, the European Central Bank, about their CBDC being something that they're intending that it doesn't compete with the euro. And I'm not sure how that's supposed to work. I mean, if it's supposed to be something where you can only spend it and you don't save it, or there's capital limits on how much you can have or how much you can use. It sort of makes it almost pointless. But if you need a CBDC to actually step in and replace the existing currency, that may have to happen if the currency does start to hyperinflate or simply become unsustainable, as we see in every other country that's faced hyperinflation. They've had to revalue the currency. They've had to say something like $1,000 is now one new dollar, something like that. So you could do that with a CBDC and say, well, now we're switching from, you know, the existing US dollar to the CBDC, and 100 physical US dollars are now one CBDC dollar, whatever they want to call it, new digital dollar or new dollar or something like that, or Fed note or whatever they call it. So I think it can be useful for the US government in terms of revaluing the currency or trying to reset it. Whether or not that will be successful is another question. But I think the control aspect is also a very interesting one. If they can make sure that not only will they monitor everything that you spend, what you spend on, how much you spend on certain things, that'll give great statistics to the government as to how they can try to central plan, or in a sort of socialist way, try to top down manage the economy, which always fails. But also, if they can control, how long you can hold those notes, those digital notes, whether you have to spend them, because there's this whole concept within mainstream economics or Keynesian economics that the economy is only working correctly if everyone is spending, and everyone needs to spend more for the economy to grow. And that's a good thing. So, it's great if people are constantly you know, replacing their phones every year, if they're replacing their laptops every year, if everything is disposable, everything is poor quality so that you can, you know, just buy a new one, throw away the old one, don't fix it, just buy a brand new one. It's sort of the broken window theory. Well, if you just break everyone's windows, that'll spur on the economy because then you'll need to replace all the windows. You need to pay someone to come and install a new window, and that creates economic growth. So we might as well break everyone's windows. That's a sort of Keynesian logic of mainstream economics. So a CBDC can be very useful in that because they could say, well, we don't need to just encourage people to buy things. We can just force them to buy things, because if they don't spend their digital dollars within, you know, 1 year, the digital dollar will disappear, or it'll go back to the government or the whatever, the Federal Reserve or whoever creates the digital dollars. You'll be penalized somehow. Maybe they can introduce negative interest rates and say, well, if you hold on to it, that's fine, but you'll lose 10% every year. You know, so you'll be again penalized for saving, for holding on to dollars. So there's many ways they can try and manipulate and control. It's sort of a dystopian reality, really. Will it help Bitcoin? I think yes, because Bitcoin doesn't do that. So if you're holding Bitcoin, it's something they can't touch, and it's also something that doesn't debase and retains its value or increases in value over time, despite whatever short-term volatility may exist. So people will flock to that asset which protects them, which allows them to save and preserve their wealth in spite of whatever dystopian central government planning may exist.
Amazing. You touched on that topic a little bit earlier about financial singularity, but I think some might have questions like, what do you exactly mean with financial singularity in aspect to Bitcoin? So let's maybe dive a little bit into that topic. What is financial singularity, and how is it like connected to Bitcoin?
I think everything converges on a point, certainly in terms of monetary assets. This is something that I think Saifedean mentions in the Bitcoin Standard, and also in his new book, Principles of Economics as well, that certainly in terms of money, there's a winner-takes-all scenario. So people think that, you know, every country must have its own individual currency. Every country must have its own money. But historically, that's not always been the case. And certainly in the 19th century, by the end of the 19th century, let's say 1880s, 1890s, you had the US dollar, you had the pound, you had the franc, and all these other currencies in different countries. But really, as Saifedean points out, these are all sort of denominations of gold, in a sense. They're just different ways of measuring gold. Because gold, due to its various qualities and the fact that it could, by the 19th century, they'd found ways of ensuring that you could actually use small amounts of gold in the same way that silver had supplied that purpose in the past through various financial instruments. You could actually, you had an asset that could be used internationally across the world. So anyone anywhere in the world could save their wealth in gold, transport it through, let's say, you know, notes that are backed by gold anywhere in the world without actually having to carry the physical gold and spend that. And you could store your value throughout time. So gold was this convergence point, this singularity of currency that prevailed at one time. So there was only one real currency that had value by the end of the 19th century. Now, at the current time, we have many different currencies. Most of them are in one way or another connected with the petrodollar, even if not directly. you know, whatever happens to the petrodollar tends to affect, have a knock-on effect on all the other currencies. And there's actually a number of currencies which are currently pegged to or connected with the dollar somehow. I mean, even El Salvador, as much as they've allowed Bitcoin to be legal tender, they're basically using the dollar most of the time as their currency. So the US dollar has become this kind of, single point that everyone's agreed on across the world at the moment. But at the same time, financially, there are many different assets, as we've mentioned, that people are storing their wealth in. So people aren't storing their wealth in the dollar, they're storing it in real estate and various other financial instruments and the S&P 500, all the stock markets and everything. So the financial singularity is really where all of that converges on a single point, not just currency, but also assets. So the current wealth that is being stored in real estate will flow out into that singularity. So as Bitcoin becomes, as people realize that it is much better to store your wealth in Bitcoin than in houses, in a market that could easily crash and something which could easily be inflated through the production of new houses, when people realize that real estate is not the best store of value, but that Bitcoin is the best store of value and the hardest asset that will ever exist, the current financialization of real estate will end, and that those trillions of dollars of wealth will flow into Bitcoin. The same thing with the stock market. The stock market, of course, represents companies, and company, you'll always have to have equity in companies, but again, the stock market is being used as a store of value. Pension funds, individuals are storing their wealth in the stock market. And even as it's going up, this is something that Michael Saylor points out, it's going up, whatever percent per annum. But a lot of that is just keeping up with inflation. The stock market is a hedge against inflation because you might as well put your money into an S&P 500 index rather than storing it in your bank account as US dollars. So again, that wealth will also flow out from the S&P 500 and the rest of the stock market into Bitcoin. And now we have that channel for that to happen through the ETFs. So it'll come from all of these different aspects, all of these different methods of saving, including gold as well. I mean, gold itself, is something like a $10 trillion asset. So it's at least, 10 times the size of Bitcoin, if not more. But that a lot of that wealth that is stored in gold will again flow into Bitcoin because it serves the same purpose as gold, but even better. So I see at some point everything converging, all of these different methods of storing wealth will converge on a single store of wealth, and that will essentially definancialize many of these assets and will actually, in a sense, make finance a lot simpler. Because now, if you want to preserve wealth, you have to, each person has to sort of be, looking at the stock market. How are things going? What should I buy another house? Should I mortgage my existing house? But once you have one simple hard asset, you essentially definancialize, you remove the need for financial advisors, their job becomes obsolete. You don't need any of these existing funds, hedge funds, indices, all of that goes out the window. And all you need is Bitcoin.
It's amazing. And I think this is, you basically described now the way to have a Bitcoinization where we use Bitcoin as the base layer of our financial system, where everybody knows Bitcoin is the place where I can store my money. And this is the beautiful thing, because I was a stock investor before Bitcoin. I picked stock, like individual stocks, not S&P 500. And I was, for some reason, quite successful in it. I think mostly to do luck, because I did not know what I'm doing there. But even though I was good in it just from a performance-based thing, people came up to me and asked me, question, how do you do that? How do you do it? And I came to know then later that all the things that they wanted is not to know how to pick stocks. They wanted to know how to secure your financial energy. And everybody has this problem. This is why families are buying houses. This is why people buy the S&P 500 and ETFs and stuff like that. And as you just perfectly described it, this all will flow at some point to Bitcoin, and we have this hyper-Bitcoinization. Was also an interesting thought experiment, and I'm curious to know what you think about that. When we have this singularity, what are the consequences of that? Like, what is coming after hyper-Bitcoinization? How does the world change because of that, or does it even change?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's something that a lot of people have thought about. Certainly, Saifa Dean mentions it in the Bitcoin Standard quite eloquently. But essentially, you know, I think that we go back, in a sense, to a sort of golden age of hard money. Something I've mentioned in a couple of my articles, that I think that there are certain things that we've lost that maybe we don't realize we've lost. For example, a focus on quality over quantity. Now everything is sort of mass produced to a certain quality to ensure that it's cheap, but also needs to be replaceable. So for example, you know, you'll have an IKEA desk or something which is cheap, but it's made of chipboard. You know, it easily breaks. It doesn't last very long. You know, I need to buy a new one in 5 years. The same with houses. I mean, houses, especially in the US, are built cheaply, but not of very good quality. You know, most of the good houses, I mean, certainly in the UK, you know, houses, a lot of our housing stock is, you know, 100 years old and fairly good quality, but the new stuff is not as good quality. So everything is in a kind of decline at the moment. Quality of everything goes down. And also the way that we think about things, we don't plan for the long term now. We tend to plan for short term, because everything is about what's happening next. What's the next thing? Nobody's thinking, you know, what will I do 100, you know, 50 years from now? What will my grandchildren do? What will my children do? What's the future that they will have? So I think, you know, a fiat currency encourages this, because it makes us make those snap decisions. We have to spend our money now. We don't save for the future. So when we have a hard money standard, people will start saving again. So instead of investing, they'll be saving. They'll use that money to provide a legacy for their children and their grandchildren. They will use the money to build businesses and grow businesses. Again, even with business now, we've converged on these massive, you know, super corporations that control everything. And the small businessman has disappeared in many cases, because there's no incentive for small business. And nobody can save up capital. No one can save up capital to start a business. No one can save up capital to provide for their future, to buy a house, to pay for education. You know, there wouldn't be so much of a focus on student loan forgiveness if people could simply save up for their studies. But now everything is too expensive because of inflation. And, you know, the education, the price of education has inflated. Maybe not as much in much of Europe, because governments will cap prices and say, well, you can't charge more than, you know, certain amount of euros per annum for university education. But in the US, you know, the cost of education, it has skyrocketed. The same with the cost of healthcare and other things. So, and real estate, of course, for people in my generation, let's say millennial generation, and also now Gen Z and other generations to come, nobody can think of buying a house because the house prices just continually go up due to it being used as a store of value and massive inflation. And nobody can save for it, because how are you supposed to save, you know, in a hard asset to buy a house? You can the only way of doing that now really is through buying and saving Bitcoin. So there's many, many different effects. I mean, even Saif Adeem will talk about things like the effect on art and culture and music, you know, that everyone's focused on the lower quality things, things that can be produced very quickly. Like, let's say I take some paint, you know, and throw it on the wall. I've created art now, and, you know, can you please buy this for $1 million? You know, that's the way people, you know, that's the way modern art is now. But art 100 years ago or 200 years ago, it took time to make. You know, one portrait or one painting took many days of concentration and labor to create the most exquisite, beautiful painting. The same thing with a sculpture. You know, it would take ages to fashion something intricate out of marble. And even architecture, you know, building a cathedral might take 100 years or 200 years to make. And it took, you know, generations of effort, generations of wealth going into a single building. But nowadays, we don't think about the long term. You know, if we want to build something, it needs to be made of concrete. It should be made within, you know, 1 year or 2 years or 5 years to build something, not 100 years, you know, or 200 years to build something. So I think we've also lost a lot of our drive. Since 1971 in particular, I think the world has kind of lost its drive, lost its focus. You know, science, innovation, research. Yeah, there are some new discoveries and things. You know, we've got better iPhones, we've got, you know, internet and things like that. But, you know, we're not really making these breathtaking discoveries anymore. You know, we went to the moon. The US went to the moon, never went back. You know, everything has been in a kind of malaise or decline. And I think on a hard money, you know, Bitcoin standard, we will actually see a new kind of renaissance of art, culture, technology, you know, low time preference things that will lead to new discoveries, new innovations, and a better future.
Yeah, definitely. It's so exciting, the time that we are able to be alive and to witness all the stuff going on with Bitcoin and with the adoption. Even internet is coming into play. Like I talked with the guy Swan about that it's crazy that we're living through the internet revolution, and then also with Bitcoin, there's an even bigger revolution going on, and it's massive that we have. We live through the early days of such an amazing change to society. Yeah? And this also brings me to my last question before we get into our end routine. What are you most excited about for Bitcoin in the coming years? Like, what are you looking forward to seeing in the next few years besides price, besides the things? Do you have any topics that you are right now or in the future really excited about?
Well, I'm not so much on the technical side of things. I don't really, you know, follow a lot of the technical developments. Some technical developments can be good, some not so much. I think we see a lot of stuff with the ordinals now and all that kind of thing, which I'm not too excited about. Anything that sort of takes up the block space that isn't sort of a monetary use of Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin's primary use case has to be monetary and storing value, but I think it will become easier to access Bitcoin. It'll be easier to onboard people to Bitcoin. I think one thing that Fred Krueger and others have pointed out is that it is actually quite difficult to get into Bitcoin for a lot of people. And I found that myself with members of my family, maybe older members of my family, who, you know, it is a challenge to actually set up an account on an exchange and go through KYC and buy a hardware wallet and set that up and, you know, store your seed key and all that kind of stuff is quite difficult. So I don't know what developments there will be in terms of onboarding, but I think it will become easier over time to onboard onto Bitcoin, either directly through buying Bitcoin and self-custody, Also through layer twos, the Lightning Network at the moment. Lightning Network's great, but again, it's something that's a bit difficult for most people to wrap their heads around, especially older generations. So if it can become easier to use the Lightning Network and integrate it into more things, into more platforms, maybe into Twitter, X, or social media, and other sort of layer two solutions that may exist that I don't know about yet or haven't been following. Even the idea of, pegging currencies, in a way, I think Saifedean in the Bitcoin Standard talks about banks getting involved with Bitcoin and, even pegging things to Bitcoin and maybe even, more financialization, as you were saying, of Bitcoin itself in terms of things like taking loans. I know Michael Saylor talks about Bitcoin being like real estate in New York, that you would never sell it, in Manhattan. You buy it and then you never sell it. But then, of course, the question is, how do you utilize your Bitcoin if you never sell it? For some people, never sell means never sell until it reaches a certain price point. But what about lending against or borrowing against Bitcoin? So far, we've had a lot of problems with that, as we've seen with like Celsius and BlockFi and these various platforms that have collapsed. It's a big risk at the moment to borrow against your Bitcoin, and you could lose it in the process. So making it easier for people to benefit from the Bitcoin they hold without getting involved in some sort of Ponzi or scam or other blockchain that muddies the waters. Being able to actually say, I've got one Bitcoin or two Bitcoin or whatever, or 0.5 Bitcoin, can I take a loan against that? Can I get a mortgage that's backed by Bitcoin, for example, so I can buy a house without actually selling my Bitcoin? So that kind of stuff, I think, will be very interesting. But I'm sure there'll be a lot of interesting developments in Bitcoin over the next 5 years, 10 years that I haven't even anticipated, that we may not even be thinking about. But there'll be a lot of exciting stuff in the pipeline, I think.
Definitely. And this is the exciting time to be around. And now we're coming to the end routine where the previous guest is asking a question for the next guest without knowing who the next guest is. And the question for you is, how did Bitcoin change you?
I think that's an interesting question. For me, I've sort of been following Bitcoin since sometime in 2017. And I've always been kind of interested in, how systems work and how history sort of leads to various developments and points. And I've also known that there's something wrong with the way things are. I've always been sort of concerned with things like, the national debt and all that kind of stuff. And, hard money, why is it that money keeps inflating and losing value? So for me, Bitcoin solved a big problem, as in how do we fix these various systemic issues with the financial system, with money, and also how can I preserve my wealth over time? If I'm earning money, I want to save that money. I want to keep it somewhere. But, if I looked at high interest bank accounts, there basically aren't any. Certainly not from around 2020 onwards. There's basically no high interest bank accounts. There's no way of saving money. So for me, Bitcoin has been a great way of saving money, storing my wealth, and being able to actually be optimistic about my own future. Because I can see, there is hope on the horizon. I can actually not only store my wealth, but actually increase my wealth without being a genius investor or businessman. I don't have to, maybe I would like to have a business one day, but I don't have to be a genius investor or businessman to increase my wealth over time, because Bitcoin is consistently going up in value over time. So, and it's also kind of given me more of that low time preference, it's helped me to be more patient. It's helped me to think, you know, I don't have to have everything now. I can, restrict what I'm spending now in order to save for the future, and I'll have a better future than my current situation now. So it's made me more optimistic, more patient, and it's allowed me to save.
Amazing. Yeah, that's so true. And it has so many ripple effects from that, what you just said. And it's great to see that happening. Nicholas, thank you for being on. It was an honor to speak with you. It was really, really cool to dive deep and pick your brain. For people that want to ask you further questions that are now more curious about the stuff you're seeing, where can people reach out to you? Where can people read more from you?
So for reading more from me, at the moment, I'm mostly posting on Medium. So I think in terms of getting in contact with me, you can follow me at Nicholas19 on Twitter. Just send me a DM or follow me on Medium at NJ Bridgewater. So yeah, get in touch if you have any questions or just want to get in touch.
Perfect. And I will keep your Twitter in the YouTube description so people can just click on it. Thank you for being on. It was an honor.